Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
So President Donald Trump said he expected Jerome Powell to be a cheap money Fed chairman and lamented to wealthy Republican donors at a Hamptons fundraiser this past week that his nominee instead has raised interest rates. This according to three people who were present in the Hamptons listening to the President of the United States. Joining us here in New York City, present with us, is John Riding, RDQ Economics chief economist and founding partner. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, John.
I guess the big important question is whether any of this influences the Federal Reserve. Does it?
If it does, it's only to be more resolved in getting on with the job of renormalizing interest rates. But to be honest, the Fed is going to be guided by the fact the unemployment rate's at 3.9%. The inflation rate is pushing above 2%. And that's going to keep the Fed on task, raising interest rates in September and December this year. And as I spoke with Tom and the TV in the last hour, four more times in 2019, regardless of what the president said. And by the way, there is nothing in Jay Powell's background to have led one to believe that he was going to be an easy money central bank head. So I don't know. I wasn't present in Hamptons. I don't vacation in Hamptons. So I can't say what was or wasn't said behind closed doors.
I can tell you who might have been there, because Tom Keene was away Friday and yesterday. So maybe, Tom, did you make it to the Hamptons?
Did. The temperature went down so VetBill could handle it.
Did you get a position in the FX market in time before the story came out?
No,
I didn't. I mean, that's what's crazy about this, right? There were people who were privy to some pretty important comments from the President of the United States in a private setting, John.
But it doesn't affect policy. Look, market moves on headlines, and we have a president who can give us more headlines than others from his own cell phone. But in the end, as a comeback, it's what the Fed does. I think that the Fed is on task here and will be more truly data-driven than it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Then push against the good economists who you agree to disagree with on this point, who say it will be damaging to raise rates. How do you respond to those good and qualified economists?
I don't see what the damage... Look, there's nothing more damaging. Again, you're talking 10 years on from the financial crisis and the last financial crisis, and the Great Recession we went through, and what were the origins of that? It wasn't that monetary policy was too tight too quickly. It was that monetary policy was far too easy for far long in a too laxly regulated capital market environment. So the thing is that, you know, going back to another famous head of the Fed, the Fed's job is to take the punch bowl away when the party's getting good. And this party has been pretty good for a good while. And they've only been sort of closing the bar in very small stages. And I think that that's what they have to continue to do. I think that's what history tells us. And when you hear unconventional central banking ideas like low interest rates are good, high interest rates cause inflation, you're talking about Turkey, you're talking about Venezuela, you're talking about Argentina.
You're talking about a very different economics textbook. John, I think it's also quite easy to point out that maybe the Federal Reserve is still quite accommodative.
Absolutely. As I said again with Tom before, the short-term interest rates are below the inflation rate. We have negative real interest rates, and that is an historical anomaly, and one that if persisted would lead to misallocation of capital. And it's that misallocation of capital, as we had the capital misallocated in the last decade, that led to the housing bubble and led to the mortgage crisis and the financial crisis.
Now, this line probably doesn't work on the campaign trail, but the yield curve is something the Fed might respond to. The Atlanta Fed president, Rafael Bostic, yesterday claimed that he will not vote for anything that will knowingly invert the curve, and he's hopeful that as we move forward, he won't be faced with that. Are we seriously facing the prospect that over the next couple of meetings we might see some dissent at the Fed because of where the yield curve is right now?
I suppose that's possible. We've had dissent at the Fed before in rate hikes last year, but the Fed is not an innocent actor on the long end of the curve. The Fed has a massive balance sheet in long-term bonds, both mortgage bonds and treasury securities, that are holding down long rates. So I will put the question back. Would President Bostic want to see a faster wind down of the balance sheet or even active sales of long end rates, which would push interest rates up, as by the way, I think will the supply of treasuries that need to be issued in order to fund the growing federal deficit.
And John, let me ask you a slightly technical question as well. Where on the curve should they be looking? Tim Dewey of the University of Oregon raised this. Is it Fed funds rate out to tens? Is it twos, tens? What are the Fed looking at?
Well, when I joined the New York Fed in 1989, the Fed's expert in that area was an economist called Arturo Estrella. I worked with him. His work was 3-month T-bills to 10-year rates, and that curve is a lot less flat than the market popularized 2-year to 10-year curve, which is where people tend to look. But I think it's pretty much the same thing. 3-month bills to 10 years is where the Fed's research points.
Within this is, I guess, the people behind Chairman Powell. As you mentioned, he's a pragmatist, but at the same time, he's not an economist. Line up the governors right now and how they will defend this chairman.
Well, I think, Jay Powell, by training, is a lawyer, is a capital markets guy. I have to say that he assimilates and understands research in a way that, might surprise economists and say, well, if you don't have a PhD, you don't have this hat, how can you get it? He gets it. And I think he is a consensus builder. And I don't think that in terms of the governors of the Fed, who are all too few compared to the 7 governors that the Fed is supposed to have, there's no... all of them would be back to the
John Riding, Jay Powell. Good to see you. IDQ Economics, Chief Economist and Founding Partner.
He is the author of Securities Regulation, Cases and Materials, 13th edition. John Farrell read that cover to cover. He is the most cited lawyer on entrepreneurial and corporate affairs. Of course, he is John Coffey. There is only one of Columbia Law School. And we are honored that Professor Coffey joins us this morning on Professor Musk. John Coffey, if you were advising Elon Musk this morning, what would you say to him?
Well, he needs to reach an agreement with his board, and he needs to reach an agreement with the SEC. And he needs very much to shrink his shareholder base. To do a going private transaction, he has to get the number of shareholders of record of Tesla below 300. Currently, they're around 1,150, so it's a 75% shrink. That's going to be hard to do. Simultaneously, he can't do this transaction if the SEC is suing him. And I think what the SEC really wants from him, and which he probably should give without a fight, is some kind of an agreement about how he will make future statements about the company and this proposed transaction. Thus, I think the SEC is going to insist that you enter an agreement that you won't make further statements on Twitter without at least first clearing them with your general counsel and the board. Okay.
John, you're in your classroom, and you mentioned Netflix and the Reed Hastings rule. We're going to make original law here to come out. Are we going to make an original law that treats technology companies like industrial companies, or is technology going to have an asterisk where they have a different securities and regulation process?
I think investors are the same. Investors invest in both kinds of companies, and investors want full information. A Twitter statement, limited as it is to something like 114 letters, really can't explain the complexity. And his statement that funding was secured was an extreme overstatement, and it's partly the product of having to compress what he was saying into a tiny number of letters. Thus, I think you need to make a fuller statement and then add your social media statements afterwards. But start out with something that you disclose to the SEC, to the market generally, and in a corporate press release.
So, Professor, there is a difference, of course, between best practice, which is something you've just described, and something that is legally required, and something that would be against SEC rules. You've served as a member on the SEC Advisory Committee, and I'm interested, Professor, as to whether you would be telling them that actually they need to rethink disclosures on social media.
Well, I think social media is useful. No one wants to keep it off of social media, but that's not inconsistent with having simultaneous statements. Make your statement on social media to that audience, but the rest of the market, not all of which goes to social media, is entitled to some disclosure that's filed with the SEC in a Form 8K or something that's put on the corporation's website where everyone knows they can go. A selective disclosure is problematic.
What should the board do? And the board is made up of different principals. Let me start with the most visible member to the audience, and that is Mr. Murdoch, James Murdoch, of course, affiliated with Fox and perhaps Disney. How should a board member like James Murdoch act and react to all of this?
Well, of course, there is a committee that doesn't include him. They've appointed a committee to engage in evaluating the company. And I think everyone should be focused on the need to come up with an independent investment banker and an independent law firm that helps this committee decide what the fair value of the company is. The price cannot be $420 just because Mr. Musk said that. The company has got to sit down and evaluate their current value, looking at all the current factors and looking at professional help from an investment banking firm. Once they do that, they might well decide they're worth more because the premium that Musk was offering was only 20%. And frankly, most going private transactions see something like a 30% premium.
John, what's the board's duty to investors right now after that interview with the New York Times?
Well, I think right now the company has so many problems with their burn rate on cash flow that they've got to make sure they can communicate clearly that they are viable, that they are not burning money at such a negative cash flow that they can't afford to issue new debt. They already have $10 billion in debt outstanding, and the idea that you can triple that is something of a fantasy.
If you're just joining us, without question, our interview of the day on equities on Tesla and corporate governance, he is John Coffey of Columbia Law School, their Burrell Professor of Law, Director of their Center on Corporate Governance. Within the board, I guess it's a smaller, more focused board, and I guess it's Friends of Elon is a board. Are they getting enough advice now? And how does the board interact with their independent law firm?
Well, they need to choose the independent law firm. They apparently have one. They really got two law firms because they got one handling the possible litigation and another dealing with evaluating the company. But the committee needs both an independent investment banker and an independent law firm that will be there focused on what is the fair value of this company today, what do we need to know, and how do we negotiate with Mr. Musk, because it is not their job to sit down and say yes to Mr. Musk. It is their job to say the fair value of this company, given all the different range of options in front of us, is at least X, and therefore we want you to improve your offer.
Is this board independent of Elon Musk, John?
So, say it again?
Is this board independent of Elon Musk?
Well, I must say that they have more relationships with him over a 20-year career than any other board I can think of right away. It's kind of an incestuous relationship because people, even on the committee, have previously been employees of Mr. Musk at other firms.
What would you do then? I mean, what would be the John Coffey action for this board? I mean, they're going through all the right things. I get that. But what is the next creative step for a board to get control of an uncontrollable founder/CEO?
Well, I think the first thing would be to establish a protocol. You will make no more statements about the company or this transaction without first having them cleared by our general counsel and by the law firm representing the independent committee. We want to make sure we don't get the obligation to fight off SEC and private lawsuits because you are too impulsive and saying things too quickly and too glibly.
What will be the lasting impact on this in Silicon Valley? I mean, I know Tesla's unique, but we've had a few other entrepreneurial tech types feeling like they play with their own record book.
Well, I'm afraid that all depends on whether this is a success or a failure. This is still a to-be-resolved drama. Every day, like a kaleidoscope, this changes in terms of whether people have losses or they have gains, whether the burn rate is so high nothing seems feasible, or whether the board should be seeking more than 420. This has to play out, and I think settling with the SEC so that you no longer have them over your shoulder putting a cloud on the transaction, and then coming up with a valuation that you're comfortable with. And that can't be just, we're going to do what Mr. Musk offers.
John Coffey, author of Entrepreneurial Litigation, Its Rise, Fall, and Future, out a few years ago, of course, at Columbia Law School. Thrilled to bring you Professor Coffey. Foreign Affairs with a new issue out, and of course the September issue is always an important event, but never more important than their new issue. Why? Because you and me, we are so dumb about the modern internet and the modern web. The book is, the magazine rather, is The World War Web, and it is absolutely brilliant, cover to cover, on stuff we don't know. With us, Gideon Rose. He is, of course, the editor-in-chief of Foreign Affairs. Gideon, congratulations on this. Let me get right to it. The internet has lost its promise. Discuss.
So thank you very much for your kind words about the issue. Basically, think of this as a four-act play. In the first act, the United States government creates the fundamentals of what we'll now call the internet.
Right.
The communications networks,
Mr.
the Defense Department stuff, all that stuff. In act two, the United States government pairs with and partners with the private sector to develop this, makes it the infrastructure generally public, and then allows private sector actors to develop all sorts of applications and so forth. This is the golden age of the internet, the 1990s, things like that. Act three. This starts to fray because the system goes on autopilot. And what happens is the large private tech companies take over large portions of the internet and become a sort of oligopoly running things on their own. Government regulators don't really get involved. And the internet takes on its own life. And during chapter three, act three, various people start to push back against the problems with the internet. The Chinese try to succeed in a cyber sovereignty in their own sphere. The Europeans try to do regulation with GDPR. The Indians try to build a new internet from the ground up on more populist public good bases. And the Americans sit around wondering, gee, can we control the tech companies? But Americans are so embedded in an Anglo-American view of liberal capitalism in
right.
which the government lets the private sector do its stuff that American policy has allowed the internet to create problems, and now other people are stepping in to fix those problems.
Explain, then, who has the power here? As you go chapter by chapter brilliantly, is it China with the power, or is it a European regulatory structure that has the power?
So the great question is, we don't know who's going to have the power in Act 4, because what happened in Act 1 and 2 was the U.S. government created the infrastructure and turned it over to the private sector to help run. And in Act 3, we ended up getting a lot of pushback. And right now, you have governments like China. You have regional regulators like those in Europe.
Right.
You have private sector companies like big tech. You have the citizens in general. And nobody knows who is going to control the commanding heights of the digital economy, like, for example, data regulation. Who is going to get to keep and control and monetize the data? The individuals,
but
the companies,
but this
the governments?
Is critical. You mentioned Commanding Heights, which is, of course, Daniel Yergin in his classic book on the 19th to the 20th century of capitalism, there were two wars in the middle of Dan Juergen's Commanding Heights. What's going to be the warfare equivalent of this technology in our society?
So it's not going to be warfare in terms of geopolitical conflict between the major powers. What's going to happen is there was a common American-sponsored liberal open order of the internet, somewhat parallel to the globalization order. And American officials moved that forward to get all the benefits.
Right.
But they forgot that the destruction part of creative destruction creates pushback and people resist. And what you're seeing now in China, in Europe, in India, even in the US, is people reacting against an unfettered private sector dominated internet, but no one knows how to reestablish control because you don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs. So what's happening right now is a question over the future control of the internet. It's not necessarily just going to be what it was in the last couple of decades, which is the United States debating whether or not to allow tech companies to have control over things. Now other global players are in fact going to be important.
How do you respond to the news just in the last 24 hours that Apple will limit X number of apps to China? I mean, within your chapter on China, they're making the rules, we're not. And even Tim Cook, chief operating officer of Tesla, bound. Tim Cook asked to bow to China.
So what I feel about this is it's a little bit like the economic nationalism in other areas that we're seeing, right? Globalization races forward. It produces lots of wonderful things, lots of creative destruction and turmoil, but it also produces pushback and problems for people inside major developed Western countries, which causes them to want to put brakes on the process. Okay? The fact is the Chinese are doing the same thing with the internet. And just like American economic nationalists and populists and British ones and places elsewhere want to hive off their economies from the globe and establish sovereignty. So the Chinese are trying to do the same thing for the internet.
Right, but we're talking about two different things, right? Getting on the one side, it's like cybersecurity and I guess, you know, the cyber race on who will have supremacy between China and the U.S. The other one is simply who is in the third act. It could be regulators, right? And this is Europe. Europe is leading the forefront regulation. I know Tom in the past has pushed back against it, but when it comes to data protection, these are the new people in town.
Yes, but it's actually there are several competitors trying to do the same thing, and we don't know which way of controlling the problems is going to win out. The European approach is regulation for the whole system. Okay? The Chinese approach is secession from the system. Cyber sovereignty, eventually, the goal of that is to create essentially a splinter net in which there's a general public internet, but the Chinese have built their own platforms, their own system, and 20 years, in effect, it'll be much more of a Chinese-dominated internet than an American-dominated one. The Indians want to re-engineer the whole thing from the ground up. Fascinating article by Nandan Nilekani from Infosys about what the Indians are doing in internet policy. It may be the most impressive and interesting of all of the different approaches, even though we don't hear much about it. And basically, in the United States, we're still wondering what to do because we don't basically have the conceptual ability to direct companies the way the government wants. And so,
okay.
Or the public wants.
Talk to me about regulation, because there's a great, great, great article in the latest edition of Foreign Affairs written by Helen Dixon saying, regulate to liberate. Can Europe save the internet? Can it?
Well, so this is the great question. We tried to present a fair picture of this whole big debate that's going forward on the future. So the lead piece in the package is by Adam Siegel talking about the transition of power from the United States to China. Helen Dixon's article expresses the European approach, which is no, it doesn't have to be the U.S. approach or the Chinese separate one. We can regulate it. Nandan Nilekani talks about the Indian one. We also have a number of different pieces on specific challenges of cybersecurity. You should look at the European approach, the Chinese approach, the Indian approach, and the American approach as variants of the same thing. Now that we've unleashed the wonderful creative destruction of digital technology, how do we keep it going forward in a positive way while controlling the social and political effects of all this creative destruction?
Would these nations ever come together, get in? I don't know whether it's a Plaza Accord for the internet, but, you know, that's the kind of idea.
So if people like John Riding were controlling this stuff, then the answer would be yes, because there's an obvious benefit for people to come together in a collective action coordination solution to reap the benefits of a coordinated policy with central regulation. But the problem is, right now, we have a tide in international politics in the United States and elsewhere, which is going inward rather than collective. And I think the answer is we're moving towards a splinter net more than we are towards a new revelation.
Can I steal that word, splinter net? Do you get a royalty on that?
It's not mine, but it's a famous
probably gets
yes.
a royalty. Here's the New York Times today, folks. I'll read it for you. Russian hackers broaden attacks to conservatives. First of all, I got to make some news here. Was accounts on foreign relations hacked by Russians? Is it within this article?
Like everybody else, we're constantly phished and attacked by various different actors. But that's just that's like the Russians don't bother me as much. The Russians are like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid harassing the railroad.
Okay, who's the Catherine Ross of the World War Web?
Well,
that's a Butch Cassidy.
It's the Chinese who are going to be building a whole new railroad. So we're worrying like E.H. Harriman and the Union Pacific Railroad about who's stealing our little.
Very good.
We're worrying about who's stealing our safe. The Chinese are going around buying up the land and running the trains and developing engine technology. 20 years from now, we're going to be running on Chinese trains, and we're going to be wondering, how did that happen?
Okay, well, then what? It's Francine's wonderful question about how do we get together on this. Where's the unifying force, particularly given the fractious politics our president's having with our allies?
Karen Kornbluh and Michelle Flournoy and Michael Sulmeyer have pieces in the article, in the package, telling you what the United States should do, and there are a lot of things. Again, I would look to the Indian approach of the internet as a public good that may hold the best solution down the long road.
Yeah, but Tim Cook's stock options is not the public good.
The question of the regulation of capitalism in a way that is beneficial economically, but also sustainable politically and socially, is going to be the question of the mid-21st century.
Gideon, do you think any of these companies would self-regulate for real? So not just talk,
yeah,
but actually
just like Martin Shkreli will self-regulate.
Look.
Yes. Yeah.
We can count on
the tech companies to self-regulate, just like we can count on the pharmaceutical companies to provide low-cost medicines for everybody without regard to jacking up things when they have a scarce monopoly like an EpiPen.
All right. Perfect. we do a little bit of. You know, that's a no, but why not? If you listen to the rationale of them regulating, it's either you regulate or you don't survive if people stop using you because you don't, you know, they don't trust. They make money out of trust. They don't make money out of selling drugs.
Yes, in the long run. But in the short run, you make money by increasing your share of things, right? We have a president right now who is ignoring the entire costs of a global trade war to get some short-term minor advantage in trivial little issues. So that kind of thinking, if it can apply to the president of the United States and the entire Republican Party, it also applies to individual private sector company managers. So we can't rely on them to be responsible for the entire global community down the road.
Gideon, thank you so much. Your most important issue, I really mean this, folks, how dumb I am on our World War Web, and I've got to read it cover to cover. Can't say enough about it.
The big question now going forward is, what will the relationship be between the U.S. and Turkey? And Turkey being its incredibly important geopolitical location that it's in, who is going to come to its rescue? And I'm really pleased to say we are now being joined by Amanda Sloat, the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at Brookings. Amanda, thank you so much for being here. So I want to start with now that we do seem to have found some stability for today in the Turkish lira, how much financial aid will Turkey need and who is going to provide it?
Well, thank you for having me, and that's an excellent question. As you said, we are seeing stability today. The money that they got from Qatar last week, the $15 billion, has helped stabilize things. But we also had Treasury Secretary Mnuchin out last week saying that the U.S. was preparing more sanctions, and we had President Trump in his wide-ranging interview with Reuters yesterday indicate his continued frustration with Turkey. So I think it is quite possible that we will see the U.S. impose sanctions or additional measures on on Turkey this week. Then we come to the question that you asked, which is how the Turkish markets will respond and what the broader challenge of this is. Turkey certainly could try and find money from other partners. They could repair U.S. ties as an easy way of dealing with this. And then there still are all the broader structural problems that we are seeing in Turkey, with one of the easiest fixes they could make is being let the central bank raise interest rates.
Yeah. And as you talk about the potential for the U.S. to place further sanctions on Turkey, we are just getting some breaking headlines that the Treasury is sanctioning Russian vessels and shipping companies and also issuing cyber and North Korea-related sanctions. So just sort of to put into context that sanctions are free-flowing these days. So it isn't a hard stretch to think that there might be more on Turkey. But Amanda, I guess that then the question becomes, you know, we did get that loan from Qatar, and I'm wondering, will Russia and will China step in to try to align themselves more closely with Turkey financially at this point?
It's certainly possible. The Turks have been in touch with the Russians. There was a call between the Turkish and Russian leaders about a week and a half ago, and last week we saw the Russian foreign minister in Turkey. The challenge is that Turkey and Russia have continued to have a difficult relationship. You may remember it was less than 3 years ago that Turkey shot down a Russian jet that had violated its airspace along the border with Syria, leading Russia to slap a number of economic sanctions on Turkey, forcing Erdogan a year later to apologize to Putin as a way of getting those lifted. So certainly any measures that come from Russia are going to have strings attached. From China's perspective, China has been investing quite significantly in other parts of Europe, and it would be in China's interest to have another foothold in Turkey, which again continues to raise questions for Europe and the United States about what the longer-term implications are going to be from greater Chinese investment in some of these allied countries.
Dr. Sloat, it's wonderful to have you with us, particularly after your public service to the nation on the watch for Southern Europe and Turkey. Can you enlighten our American listeners on the importance and present fragility of this large airbase we have in Turkey? Is it at threat? Is it an important pawn in this debate? Or even with the rhetoric, is it truly untouchable?
It certainly is an asset that the Turks could use in retaliation for American sanctions on them. It's a Turkish base that the U.S. has been using for an extended period of time. The U.S. Yeah. has various strategic assets that are located there. It's also been very helpful to the U.S. in terms of prosecuting the fight against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, since being able to fly missions from the base is much easier than having to fly off carriers the Gulf. So far, there has been some musing among some lower levels officials, I think in Turkey, some pundits in Turkey, that it could be put on the chopping block. I am not aware of Erdogan or any senior Turkish officials making that threat, although it's certainly something that has come up periodically in the past when the U.S. has done things that Turkey has not liked.
So from where you sit, I'm sure the president has his own agenda separate from that. Is the new State Department advising perspective to the president on complexities like that airbase?
I am sure the State Department and the Pentagon are feeding all of that information into the White House. But as you say, it is not clear to me that President Trump is taking some of these broader considerations into account.
Who is Turkey's ally?
Well, it depends on the day, and it depends on the issue. One thing that's been quite striking in Turkey over the last couple of weeks is that we're seeing them try to mend relations with European countries that they have had very frayed relations with. It's quite striking this week that you have the Germans coming out musing about whether or not they need to provide financial support to Turkey, since it's certainly not in Europe's economic interest to see the Turkish economy tank. And over the last couple of years, Germany itself has had very difficult relations with Turkey following accusations of Nazi-like behavior when the Germans didn't allow Turkish ministers to campaign to diaspora communities before a constitutional referendum. Turkey was also imprisoning some German citizens on spurious charges.
Yeah.
And these things led the Germans to impose some of their own economic measures in terms of issuing travel advice to citizens, limiting the number of export credits that they were giving to their own businesses. So it's quite a role reversal when we now have the Germans having gone through something quite similar with the Turks, now wondering if they're going to have to come to Turkey's defense to help stabilize its economy.
Yesterday on Bloomberg Radio, we were speaking with Admiral James Stavridis, who formerly was the military commando of NATO, as well as the U.S. Navy admiral. And he was saying that there is a chance that perhaps Turkey would leave NATO. And if it did, it would be disastrous for the U.S. Do you agree?
Yes, I definitely think it would be disastrous. There has been talk about whether or not NATO should kick Turkey out. NATO does not actually have any mechanisms to do that, so it's a decision that Turkey would have to take itself. I have not seen any indication from Turkish leadership that that's something that they want to do. I think a lot of their regional security comes under the auspices of the NATO umbrella. Turkey has continued to be a good player and member of NATO in the sense of contributing very actively to the ongoing mission in Afghanistan. They are the alliance's second largest military, and actually they are one of the countries that is on track to meet defense spending targets within the next couple of years.
This has been wonderful. Don't be a stranger. Dr. Amanda Sloat with Brookings, her public service again to the U.S. government, is Deputy Assistant Secretary for Southern Europe and Eastern Mediterranean Affairs. Dr. Sloat, thank you again so much. Of course, serving now at Brookings as well. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.